talking once again with Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat This State. Good morning.
Good morning.
And no Maria this morning. And we're not sure. She's kind of burnt out on doing the show and as well as writing. So we're not sure if this is just, you know, a temporary thing or a permanent thing. So I know that's people are going, oh no, I can hear that all the way over here, even with the headphones
yeah,
on.
Yeah, it's we certainly hope she comes back. She's been a remarkable part of the show for the last couple 3 years.
So I think regardless of whether she comes back or not, and a good thing to do would be if you're at home and you've appreciated up to this point her her fine comments on the radio as well as her excellent writing, sending like a card or a letter or whatever to the station, and I can pass that on to her. I think it would be a cool thing. So you can send those to Maria Tomczyk in care of me here at the station. My name is Mike McCormick, and our address is KEXP 90.3 FM Seattle, 113 Dexter Avenue North, Seattle, Washington 98109. So, and you can get that off our website as well, kexp.org.
So, and what's the email they should send it to?
Well, that's a good question. If they send it to the DJ email here, you're gonna knock out our computers because they're just gonna get too many. So it's best for just to do the cards and letters, something physical there, and it's one of those rare occasions where I think email wouldn't be as effective. But let me know if that's not gonna work for you. You can send it email to dj@kexp.org. And heck, we'll hire the extra people to forward them. So, all right. Well, let's move into the week's news. There's no shortage of things happening.
Not at all.
And let's start with what is turning into a regular spot, the Abramoff update.
Yeah, it was a busy week for Jack Abramoff. He spent Tuesday in Washington, D.C., pleading guilty to mail fraud, tax evasion, and conspiracy charges. And then on Wednesday, he was in Miami pleading guilty to wire fraud and forgery charges. Those are the charges for which he was indicted in August for the, excuse me, for the Sun Cruise gambling boat scandal, where he defrauded the previous owner of $23 million. And his business partner, Michael Scanlon, wasn't really as highlighted in the news coverage this week. Scanlon, the former chief of staff for Tom DeLay, who was the business partner of Abramoff for the last 4 or 5 years, defrauding Indian casinos of large amounts of money. He also pled guilty. Abramoff is facing up to 30 years in prison. He'll probably get 9 or 10. He also has to pay restitution of about $25 million. Scanlon has to pay back $19 million. It's been a really interesting media week. This was big news for about a day or two, and then the mine disaster pushed it off the front page. I hope this story does not go away. It's huge. We're going to be seeing a lot of Congress people indicted. Probably the first one will be Robert Ney from Ohio. He was actually mentioned in the charging papers for Abramoff under the very ineffective pseudonym of Representative Number One. But the things that they described Representative One of doing was exactly what Nye is on the record as having done, putting praise for Abramoff's purchase of Sun Cruise into the congressional record and things like that in exchange for money. So Nye is probably going to be charged with bribery charges fairly soon. But there's, Ney and John Doolittle, representative from California, Senator Conrad Burns from Montana, are basically the three Congress people who are mentioned most in news counts. But we know already that there are upwards of 4 dozen Congress people, most of them Republicans, who have been traced as getting money, campaign donations, travel, or gifts from Abramoff or his clients in exchange for taking legislative action favorable to to Abram Moffat as a client, as, or his clients. Those things happened at precisely the same time. Now, whether it was a quid pro quo, that's what has to be proven in a court of law, and probably won't be proven for all of those folks, but a good many, and many of them will be charged, and we haven't heard most of those names yet. We will in the future. A number of Congress people were scrambling this week to give back the money that they'd gotten from Abramoff. Maria Cantwell here in Washington gave back $18,000. Interestingly, Patty Murray, who is the second leading Democrat in Congress in terms of money that she's gotten from Abramoff, it's approximately $50,000, is refusing to give any of it back. Cantwell gave hers to the North American Indian Congress Education Fund, but Murray's not giving any of it back. The other interesting thing is that George Bush gave back $6,000 that he got from Abramoff, and he was claiming that he didn't know Jack Abramoff. Well, both of those are anywhere from disingenuous to not true. Bush met with Abramoff and several of his Native American clients in the White House in April of 2001. Abramoff actually bought access with the president. He took, I believe it was a substantial amount of money in order to get these Native American representatives FaceTime with the president. You know the culturally conservative president who's opposed to gambling, but he's certainly willing to take money in exchange for, or Abramoff is willing to take money and then pass money on to the president in exchange for the FaceTime. But Abramoff's ties to the president go a lot deeper than that. He's been a pioneer. That means a person who's raised over $100,000 in both the 2000 and 2004 elections. In fact, in 2004, he was so far over the $100,000 mark that he stopped raising money and attributing it to himself and started helping out some of his colleagues so they could become pioneers as well. At the same time, he was also on Bush's transition team in 2001. He was named on the transition team to the Department of the Interior, which, of course, oversees Native American tribes. This is a guy who represents Native American casino interests, which again, tells you a lot about how the Bush administration has worked in terms of who makes policy in the Bush administration. It's the people who have direct ties to the industries that are supposedly being regulated, or in this case, the constituencies that are supposedly being overseen, Native Americans. A number of other interesting aspects to this that came up this week that we'll be getting into in future weeks. But it was definitely a week in which Republicans are getting a little bit skittish, and this is likely to be an issue all the way from now to the 2006 elections in November.
Did Patty Murray give any reason why she's not giving back the $50,000?
Not that I saw. Maybe she did, but she basically said she was not giving the money back. That's all I saw in the news article on it.
Okay. Well, let's move along. The NSA spying scandal appears to continue to percolate.
Yeah, there were a couple of really interesting revelations this week. One came from the office of Nancy Pelosi, the House of Representatives Democratic leader, who apparently wrote a memo in October of 2001. This is just after 9/11, objecting to the NSA spying on Americans without warrants. This is exactly the same program that we're talking about. This was months before Bush signed his executive order. So even if the White House's executive order, that the one being justified by Bush being a wartime president and therefore having the authority to override any law, which is, you know, pretty legally dubious, even if that could be construed as legal, the White House didn't even do that much for the first several months of the program. This program actually started literally within a day or two after 9/11. They started it immediately. One other interesting tidbit that came out, and this was actually dug up by somebody who didn't, because people didn't know what it meant at the time, but in the confirmation hearings of this was an October 2001 report, from in Congress, I believe, that the NSA destroyed the records of destroyed the names of thousands of Americans whose information they had gotten through domestic spying in the time between September and October of 2001. So again, this is concrete proof that the NSA was doing this sort of illegal spying long before Bush signed his executive order. We also had a finding this week from the nonpartisan Congressional Research Service that said that the legality of the legality of the White House program for the warrantless spying was very, very dubious. That it was probably in illegal order. This was not a partisan Democratic attack. This is a nonpartisan congressional research arm that determines the legality of bills and laws that are passed by Congress. And we also had an interesting letter from Representative Jane Hannon of California, who's the ranking Democratic member on the House Intelligence Committee, saying that the White House may have violated a law in another respect, in that the National Security Act of 1947 requires that the White House inform the House and Senate Intelligence Committees of any major developments in the intelligence community or any major programs, and that they are required to inform all members of the committee. Now, the White House, when it was covering its legal tracks by informing a few hand-picked members of Congress, basically the House Majority and Minority Leaders and the heads of the Intelligence Committee, when they did that, they only informed the ranking Republican Democratic members of the House Intelligence and Senate Intelligence Committees. They didn't inform all members of the committee. And Hannon is saying that that also was a violation of law.
All right. Well, sounds like we can continue to expect more revelations as time goes on.
Yeah, and anybody who actually pulls them out will probably be added to the wiretap list if they're not there already.
Yeah, as well as the no-fly list.
Yes.
There's numerous lists that you can get on now. All right, talk about the torture bill signing.
Yeah, this was an interesting thing that came out when Bush, a week ago yesterday, signed into law the bill that had in it the McCain torture provision that basically bans U.S. Personnel, whether they are in the military services or intelligence services, from conducting torture. And we've talked already on this show about the ways in the way which the White House was planning to get around this bill. They put a new section in the Pentagon getting around this also. They put a new section in the Army Field Manual on permissible intelligence gathering techniques, basically vastly expanding the number and type and severity of intelligence gathering techniques that were permissible, various other ways in which they probably intended to go right ahead torturing. Well, Bush said an interesting thing. The same rationale that he used for the NSA spying, that is, as wartime president, the commander-in-chief has the right, and probably in his mind, the duty to ignore any law that he sees fit. He basically said that he was going to do the same thing with the torture law, that when it was an issue of national security, and of course what intelligence gathering on a war on terror is not national security, he was going to feel free to ignore this law. So we have, once again, Bush saying flat out, I'm going to break the law. Now, there is no question of congressional intent on this, because when Congress was considering this, and when Bush and McCain were negotiating their deal last month, the White House pushed very hard for an exception to this law that would allow Bush to implement it in a time of emergency, the so-called ticking clock scenario, where it's 11:58 and there's a bomb that's due to go off at midnight, and you've got to get the thumbtacks in there in 30 seconds or you're not going to find out where the bomb is. These totally ridiculous Hollywood scenarios of how terrorism doesn't work, but they've been trotted out with quite a few regularity by torture's defenders. The White House was trying to get this into law, and Congress overwhelmingly rejected it. It was offered as an amendment when the bill was working its way through Congress, and then it was raised again during negotiations with McCain, and on both of those occasions, it was flat-out rejected. So there's no question that this is something that Congress did not want, and Bush is going ahead and ignoring the will of Congress.
All right. Well, talk about something that people will be catching on the news starting Monday. Alito is beginning. They're beginning the hearings for.
Oh, yeah. Oh, by the way, one other thing that mm-hmm. I forgot to mention. There was also an item this week where the Bush administration had had its case in court. AP is suing the Bush administration to release the names of Guantanamo Bay detainees. And the Department of Defense lost on that case. A federal judge in New York named Jed Rakoff rejected the DOD arguments. It is not a final decision yet, but it looks very likely that after 4 years, we're going to finally learn who actually is in Guantanamo. So that was a little bit of good court news this week.
Any idea when AP actually started that action? I'm just curious if that was recent or if they've been going at
This has been going at it for a long time. I don't know if it was it started right after 9/11 or if it came out in 2002 sometime, but certainly no more recent than that.
Okay. Well, talk about Alito and the his potential for the Supreme Court.
Yeah, there are a lot of different issues that are very troubling about Samuel Alito. His confirmation hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee begin on Monday, and there's a lot of troubling things about Alito. His views on Roe v. Wade are very clearly known, and he's very much a swing vote on that issue. We could see if Alito is confirmed the confirmation, or rather the death of Roe v. Wade and the banning of abortion. Certainly we will see further chipping away at the law, but we could lose it entirely in the relatively near future if Alito is confirmed. But beyond that, Alito has a very, very troubling record on a number of scores. Of course, he's defending this exactly the sort of domestic warrantless NSA spying and government spying that Bush is now carrying out. He advocated for it in a case that came up when he was a member of the Reagan Justice Department. He has a long, long track record as a member of the Federalist Society and on the court bench as well of favoring executive power. He's never met an expanded government power that he didn't like. He's never met a challenge to government power that he didn't try to strike down. He has a history as a member of an alumnus group in Princeton that was basically trying to work against and opposing the presence of women and minorities of all kinds on the campus in Princeton, where he went to school. He has issues around his refusal to recuse himself from cases involving a corporation in which, or a mutual fund actually, in which he has hundreds of thousands of dollars invested, and he ruled in favor of that company when he was on the federal bench and did not recuse himself, even though in his confirmation hearings for his federal bench appointment he promised to recuse himself. There are a lot of ways in which he has gone back on his word over the years, or he's said things that he has refused to uphold, which raises the question of whether anything that he says during his confirmation hearings can be believed, because once he's on the Supreme Court, there is no recourse. There is no accountability. He's there for the rest of his life. This could be a very, very dangerous guy, very much in favor of the expansion of corporate and government power, very much in favor of stripping away the civil liberties of ordinary Americans, very much in favor of shutting off redress for civil rights violations, for example, discrimination in the workplace, that kind of a thing. There's just so many ways in which this guy is bad news. Folks should be taking very seriously trying to get a hold of members of Congress, members of the Senate, that is, and urging them to not approve Alito for the Supreme Court. Obviously, Murray and Cantwell here in the state of Washington as Democrats, and hopefully Democrats will find the courage to filibuster this nomination. But it's not going to take just Democrats. You're going to need 50 votes, because if the Democrats do filibuster, Frist will almost certainly try to invoke the nuclear option. Conservatives want to get this guy on the Supreme Court desperately, because they know that once on the Supreme Court, he will be able to leverage radical changes in favor of social conservatism and in favor of big business on the Supreme Court. So it's not just going to take Democrats. It's also going to take targeting some of the moderate Republicans in the Senate, people like Arlen Specter, Chuck Hagel, Susan Collins, Olympia Snowe, Lincoln Chafee, you know, folks who are many of these from the states in the Northeast. Those folks also have to be urged to oppose the Alito nomination. We will need 51 votes for this. And I would encourage people to take very seriously the idea of contacting members of the Senate and urging all of their friends and colleagues to do the same. This is a big deal.
All right, moving on to international. Prime Minister Ariel Sharon suffered a stroke this week.
Yeah, and his prognosis is pretty grim. Until at least tomorrow, he's in a medically induced coma. He's had three separate brain surgeries since his initial stroke on Wednesday. Actually, had a minor stroke in December, but a major one, I believe, in the same area of the brain on Wednesday. Now, in 1998, I had a stroke, and I hope I never go through that again, because it was a scary, scary thing. And it obviously wasn't anywhere near as severe. But even with my relatively mild one, it was very difficult to recover from. Doctors have no idea what the extent of the damage to Sharon's brain has been from this, whether he's paralyzed, whether there's been brain damage, any of that. But the idea that Sharon is ever going to be likely to recover, even if he survives, and that right now is pretty unlikely. But even if he survives, the chance that he's going to be Israel's prime minister in the future, very, very unlikely, I think. Now, Israel has an election for prime minister and for parliament scheduled for March 28th. And Sharon had been way ahead in the polls. He had broken off from the Likud party and founded a new, more centrist party called Kadima. He was their standard bearer, and he was very likely to be returning to the prime minister's office as the head of Fatima. That is almost certainly not going to happen now. In fact, I would say certainly not going to happen now. So there's likely to be major changes ahead in Israel and with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in 2006. We've got elections coming up for both Israel and for the Palestinian Authority. Obviously, there's a lot of other things going on in the Middle East as well. So one of the stories that media in the U.S. certainly have not been paying that much attention to, even though with the resettlement of some settlers in the Gaza Strip, the erection of the separation wall throughout the West Bank and cutting off a lot of Palestinian communities. There's been a lot of things going on in Israel-Palestine in the last year or two that haven't gotten that much attention in the United States, and it's time we start paying attention because the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is at the heart of every interaction between the United States and the Muslim world. It's critical for national security that we pay more attention to this.
All right, let's move over to This Week in Iraq.
Well, I'm a pretty poor substitute for Maria when it comes to expertise in Iraq, but there were a lot of things that that happened this week, and I will try to keep the standard high. Nearly 200 people have died in the last couple of days in suicide bombings and other attacks in Iraq. It's been a very deadly week, and at the same time, there have been a lot of protests. Over 5,000 Shiites rallied on Friday in Baghdad. They're opposing both Sunni clerics and politicians and the Americans that they say are supporting them in the political process for claiming fraud in the December 15th election. Now, next week, the final results will be in from that December 15th election. They're widely expected to give Shiite clerics and Sunni clerics greater power, move Iraq that much closer both to theocracy and to a close this alliance with Iran, and you're going to see much more of a mandate for the Iraqi government to try and challenge the authority of the United States and the presence of United States troops in Iraq. One of the other things that's going on, which is making the United States even more unpopular than it already was, is the rise in gas prices there, which I don't think we've talked about so far. This came as the condition of an IMF loan in December for what was the total here? $685 million in IMF debt forgiveness. It required the lifting of oil supports for prices. And since then, there's been a fivefold increase in gasoline prices in Iraq. Last summer, the price of gas in Iraq, and of course, this is the second largest oil reserves in the world, was 5 cents a gallon. By next summer, it's likely to be more like a dollar a gallon. And for a country that already has something like 70% unemployment, widespread poverty, people are just scraping by. Price raises have been disastrous. There have been riots about this all across Iraq, and people protesting this. And they see the United States as the force behind Iraq with a lot of these gas prices. This is something that the Bush administration has consistently tried to do, is privatize private industry in Iraq. And of course, the oil industry is very much at the heart of that. We have also here a paper from Nobel laureate Joseph Stiglitz and Harvard budget expert Linda Hilmer, saying that the cost of the Iraq war is not just the $300 billion that so far that's been appropriated by the government, but that is so far in the neighborhood of $1 to $2 trillion to the American taxpayer, factoring in costs like lifetime VA and VA health and disability costs, cost to the economy, things like that. So it's been a very, very expensive war. There was a report this week in the Washington Post saying that the Bush administration is not going to allocate any more reconstruction funds above and beyond the $18.4 billion that have been allocated since 2003. Of course, that in large part is because reconstruction has been a failure and it's ground to a halt because of security concerns. And finally, Military Times poll this week. This is something they do every year. Last year, 63% of soldiers supported George Bush's Iraq policy. It's down to 54%, a bare majority this year. And of course, this a constituency, only 13% of which identify themselves as Democrats. So it's a very conservative constituency. 54% the total that approve of Bush's policies in Iraq. 46% do not approve.
All right. Well, I wanted to squeeze in here also an obituary this week of the My Lai hero Hugh Thompson Jr. died. He was 62 years old, and getting some feedback there. Let me just read this from the Associated Press real quickly. Early on the morning of March 16th, 1968, Thompson, door gunner Lawrence Colburn, and crew chief Glenn Andriotta came upon U.S. ground troops killing Vietnamese civilians in and around the village of My Lai. They landed the helicopters in the line of fire between American troops and the fleeing Vietnamese civilians and pointed their own guns at the U.S. soldiers to prevent more killings. Colburn and Andriotta had provided cover for Thompson as he went forward to confront the leader of the U.S. forces. Thompson later coaxed civilians out of a bunker so they could be evacuated and then landed the helicopter again to pick up a wounded child they had transported to a hospital. Their efforts led to a ceasefire order at My Lai.
Yeah, Thompson should have been considered an American hero, and it's a shame that people don't know his name or didn't know his name.
Yeah, it took many years for that to come out. They did eventually, because of different work by citizens, receive the Army honored the three men with the prestigious Soldier's Medal, the highest award for bravery in not involving conflict with an enemy. So Hugh Thompson Jr., dead this week at 62. We are talking, as we do every week, with Job Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State, and tell people where they find Eat the State.
Well, first of all, there's an event that's going on today that I wanted to mention, along with the fact that the Alito's hearings start Monday, and to contact Cantwell and Murray and any other senator you feel like. This afternoon, there's something called Operation Homecoming. It's a town hall regarding policy in Iraq. The keynote speaker, Jim McDermott, there will be a number of group leaders. This won't just be talking. McDermott will have his say, but the bulk of the afternoon from 1 to 4 o'clock will be spent in breakout sessions talking about organizing campaigns around the war in Iraq. I'll be helping to facilitate the media discussion. This will be at the Labor Temple down at Broad and First Avenue in Belltown from 1 to 4 o'clock, and it's sponsored by the Backbone Campaign, Code Pink Seattle, and the Progressive Democrats of America.
All right, and very quickly, where do people find 8 the State?
It's a newsletter or newspaper that comes out every couple of weeks. It's free. It's found in bookstores and cafes and places like that, and it's also on the web, www.eatthestate.org. If you have comments, tips, want to donate, want to volunteer, any of that, give our voicemail a call, area code 206-719-6947.